Our last invited speaker today is a man who actually spoke to us in 2002 at the International Conference that year. And before I introduced him back then, he says, "Look, John, I don't want you to introduce me as the guy who invented Lisp, or as the guy who founded Lucid, the Lisp company, or as the guy who wrote the book on..." Well, see, these things I wasn't supposed to say that he wrote the book on Lisp, the Lisp benchmarking. I wasn't supposed to say that he had a PhD from somewhere and did some work in an AI program. So I didn't say none of these things, or at least I didn't think I did. I'm only supposed to say that he's a poet and that he lives somewhere in California where he observes but does not participate in ordinary life.
So I'm going to talk about some ideas that a small group that I have over at Sun Labs are working on. And I'm going to try to give you the talk in the order of, that we came up with the ideas. And during the talk, I will be quoting some of you in the room. So, one of the things to notice about programming is that it follows the manufacturing model. What this means is that there's a factory someplace where people sit and they type in code, and then when they get done, they deliver it to a user. And what they do at the factory is they do all the design, all the implementation, all the testing, the installation time. And then they ship it to someone like you, and you and it are on your own. Now, you might think that that has to do with static requirements, and it kind of does, in a certain way of looking at it. So, back at the factory, there are requirements, and programmers discover them. They can use CRC cards and test-driven design, which are like what Henry was talking about, but people actually listen to the sentences in English instead of a programmer. And then when they send the system out to the field, it sort of sits there in a static, brittle, inflexible way. But there are some feedback loops. So feedback loops kind of exist in large cycles. So it's not entirely static in that way. It's not entirely static as programming models either, or architecture. So there are plug-in architectures. So Photoshop is an example of that. There are web services, which is similar, only different. There's some amount of customization that you can do. So we're talking about what happens to the code once it leaves the factory. So you can do some look and feel stuff. There's some keyboard shortcuts you can do. You can screw around with the menus, etc. You can screw around with colors. And you can, you know, hack and do kind of scripting languages or otherwise make some small changes. The fundamental observation, though, is that requirements, getting them right before building something, is impossible. Right? In case you didn't believe me then, I'll say it again. Getting requirements right before building something really is impossible. Okay? Especially when you consider that software creates its entire world and its own physics and its own narratives. There are no constraints on it. So people have noticed this, and one of the current terms for what they do about that is called continuous redesign. So the open source community is described as doing this. And so what the people who describe open source this way say design is the result of slowly dawning insights. In fact, the way that Henry showed his hapless program, trying to program from English and getting some things right, getting some things wrong, going back and fixing it, is how it really works. And you all know that's how it works. You can pretend it doesn't work that way, but it does work this way, because everything that people do works this way. So over time, we've adapted and changed and tried new methodologies, software development methodologies, to try to fix this up. So we've tried ways of getting the requirements right. So there's super heavy-duty requirements gathering, and so sometimes the government does that, or the government requires that sort of thing. Some people use mathematical specs, thinking that, well, if you just get those right, then you can go to the program more easily. But people have tried other things too, so the agile and extreme programming methodologies, which basically is design a little, build a little, test a little, see how it goes, etc. So what, one of the things that this little group that I have over at Sun Labs was thinking about is, what would it mean for software to finally grow up and take responsibility for its end of the bargain? So it gets shipped out there. Software can do stuff. So when it gets there, it just doesn't have to sit there like a toaster. It can notice things. It can act. It can sense its environment. It can react to changes. It can affect its environment. So in some sense, this is what we try in AI. So yeah, we can build software that actually does stuff. Okay? So we're not that ambitious. We're just saying there are things that you can, that the software can do that's less than be completely brilliant. Can sort of be accommodating. It can be grown up. It's not like an infant. You have to change its diapers all the time. So we wanted to start to think of software as a collaborator. So, and we meant very simple things by this. So examining its environment before it's installed to see what it has to do to install properly. Monitor the changes that occurs to the environment it's in and try to adapt to those. And to pay attention to how it's being used and become easier to use for it now. Going a little further, perhaps the software could be active in its own development, kind of suggest changes that should be made, or make some of them itself. And most importantly, accept and provide for its own death and replacement. Okay, death and replacement. So there's an interesting story, which I'll reveal. At Sun Microsystems, we are not that smart on doing installation. And so they did an experiment. They wanted to provide an installation script for some complicated piece of software. So what they did was they got a bunch of sysadmins. They put in one of these rooms, these usability rooms, and they videotaped them and watched them. And they had a bunch of computers and they were supposed to install the stuff, the sysadmins. Plus, they could do the, we want to be a millionaire, what's the name of that program? They could phone a friend. So they could call their friends and say, okay, what do I do next? So this six or seven sysadmins spent like 10 hours and got the bits in the right place, like phoning friends and trying all sorts of stuff. And they threw a party because they got the bits right. So installation is more than getting the bits in the right place. There are customizations, there's fitting in the environment. You know, when you guys upgrade to a new operating system, you have your sort of comfortable environment that you want to be able to use again. You normally have to re-customize some of the things. So there's fitting in, there's discovering what preferences should be. Those are relatively easy things to do, but no one thinks to do that with software. They think that getting the functionality right, getting the bits in the right place is all that's really necessary. So what do I mean by this? So if you, the software can notice by sniffing around in the file system that it's an Adobe shop. That is to say, the person has tons of Adobe stuff sitting on their disk drive. So when it wants to look for a PDF browser plugin, it might as well use the Adobe one, since that's probably what the person is going to do anyway. It can kind of look at the colors on the screen and say, yeah, this guy kind of likes blue. It can ask, well, I wonder how spell checking is done around here. I need to do some spell checking, and maybe there's some dictionaries that exist, or there's some program that they like. Perhaps they want to use our favorite, Emacs key bindings, or how about using Emacs itself? So now we can start to look at what does it take to do some of that kind of stuff. And when you start to look at that stuff, you start to realize, and I will hammer this home to you, that the kinds of principles for software design, programming, when you look at it in this way, it's kind of unlike what we're taught at school, or the good language principles, languages are designed. So visibility is one of them. In order to find out, for example, how is spell checking done around here, you have to look around. You want to peer into the code and stare at it. Okay? So that implies that there's some kind of description of what the software is like, some description of what's going on, description of how it's working, so the description of its state of mind, its state of health. So when you start to look at it that way, you'll notice that any piece of code, any component, any class, any function, any whatever you want to call it that you do, has some internal vocabulary that the designer, the implementer uses. And that there's sort of the problem of abstraction is, and interfaces, is to translate between the vocabularies on the outside and the vocabularies on the inside. So when you can look at this visibility thing, look at descriptions, you can do continuing, and you can use that for adaptation. Now, when we think about this, we think more in terms of this ability to see into the program, to be multidimensional and not a stream of telemetry. So we're kind of thinking a little bit along the lines of Sharon Lanier's Phenotropic. The other thing is when you look at architectures, maybe the way that components interact are not by lines, but by blending. That when you add some component in, it isn't that there's some wire and some protocol, some signal to get sent over a wire. But maybe there's sort of the way that any living organism creates itself, that there's growth, and growth in an environment. In context, so that when you grow things, you're growing it to be adaptable there. And some of the model-driven architecture, some of the generative programming models that people are doing, are taking some advantage of this already. So as you're kind of listening to what I'm saying, talking about visibility and some of these other characteristics you might want software to have, you're saying, well, but, this is crazy because we've been taught information hiding is the source of all progress that we've made, encapsulation, static typing. This is how we made progress. Okay, so it is true, this is how we made progress. But notice that almost all of these things have to do with controlling or providing safety nets or providing mechanisms for system designers to use. So information hiding is for the programmer, it's not for the program. So we kept on thinking, and we talked about never-ending installation. That when you install one piece of software, or you do that, that there's it doesn't end when you think you're done. Every time you add new capabilities or install a new software, maybe you have to go back and reinstall or re-customize the software that you already have, because now you've got some new capability, your work habits are different, so maybe the software wants to accommodate that. In order for software to become conscientious and have its own sort of life after the factory, there has to be some sort of more complete packaging. What this means is that you don't just ship a bunch of binaries and say, here, take this. You need to be able to make some changes. To make changes, you probably need something that's like source code. You need to be able to build with it. You need to be able to run the tests. So the tests that the developers and the designers figure out at the factory need to probably run when they're out in the field. So that gives you sort of the start of a different way of looking at the thing. If you had complete packaging, you'd solve one of the actually significant problems in the scientific computing arena and in the business arena, which is lost source code. So I had the pleasure of working with a company called Park Place Systems, not related directly to Xerox PARC, Park Place Systems. And what we did was we did small talk stuff for businesses. So they're trying to replace COBOL, basically. What we learned was that Park Place's customers, for them, 60% 60, like more than half, of the code that they had been running and their business would rely on, they did not know where the source code was, and they were certain they could not find it. And so what they were constantly doing is wrapping and encapsulating these binaries that they had, making them work on every new release of an operating system, what other software they're interested in. They came up with techniques called screen scraping to do new types of input and to other components by actually looking at what is on the screen. When you have all of the source code sitting out in the world, then there's the possibility of bringing in some biological ideas, like crossbreeding. So you have an actual population. So you have a bunch of individuals that are adapted to local conditions. Maybe they're adapted by people making changes. Maybe they can crossbreed. It's a concept we don't really think about. Continual testing. So the idea here is you want to test before, test after, and sort of continually be testing your code to see if things are going wrong. That the assumptions that the designers and implementers had when they built the code, are they still true? Or are they varying? To help out with the factory, there can be end-user written tests. So one of the things that Henry should maybe know about is there are people who are doing test-driven design, and the part of the programming that they try to do with natural language is user tests. End-users write tests, they write them in English, and they very simple stylized English, and then that turns into code that gets as part of the specification. Continual noticing. So noticing what the software is doing, noticing how the components are running, noticing what the environment is like, and adjusting and adapting using feedback. So mostly I did this slide because I found this great picture of Bullwinkle. And some of you can probably recognize the script that Bullwinkle is working on. And when I was doing these very slides, I was digitizing some audio tapes of my rock and roll band. And so my computer, being very smart, said, so I've got two things going on. I've got this weird process that I don't quite understand, doing something with the FireWire or the disk drive. And I've got this moose who's typing in the script for one of the Bullwinkle bits. Well, I got to give more of the CPU to Bullwinkle than to the stupid thing. So on the other hand, when the CPU doesn't go to Audacity, that's all I'm saying. It'll drop a significant amount of music. So we have to go back and do it again. So this is part of this continual noticing, sort of feedback loop. So you can use the concept of deep noticing to do something like, well, suppose that the system notices that there's a large or a high frequency of doing something, then say, oh no, and undoing it. So maybe there's something wrong with the user interface, maybe something wrong with that piece of code. So in this way, the system, the software, can notice what it's doing, and notice how it's either helping or hurting, and perhaps go and talk to the factory. Another concept we looked at was exercise. So if you think of exercise in the context of software, exercise means testing, let's exercise the code, let's send it out to users and exercise it. Whereas if you think about yourselves, when you exercise, you become more fit, you become better at certain things, you become stronger, you improve, there are structural changes to you. When you exercise the software, that doesn't happen. Then we finally looked at some interesting research by primarily some folks over at MIT, Martin Reinhardt, computer scientist, on self-sustaining or self-repairing code. It's kind of an interesting idea. The idea is that to become accustomed to or at peace with running code that's broken, And then perhaps there's code that will fix up the problems as they're noticed, and then keep on going. Call it acceptability or acceptability of programming that he does it. So just to give you an idea of this, when a lot of people think of program traits, they think of this thin red line. You know, when I design a program, it's going to do exactly this. Well, that's not always true. Sometimes that path is wide. Here's an example. Suppose that you're playing some game. So we heard about some games in one of the technical tracks today. So imagine that it's an American political thing, which means it's a shoot 'em up. And so it's rendering lots of interesting scenes using triangles. So what you're going to do with these triangles, you're going to figure out the color and the luminosity and the blah, blah, blah shading. So, well, some of them are degenerate. So you're going to divide by zero. Okay? So now, as computer scientists and stuff say, oh my God, divide by zero. Well, you know, we're going to have to use some IEEE thing, or use intervals, or have to put all these if statements, or have exception code, or do all sorts of stuff like that. Because what does divide by zero mean? But in this context, it doesn't really matter. So the idea is, well, what if we just return 7? Divide by zero, just return 7. So what is that going to do? Well, maybe some shade of red on someone's head exploding is going to be slightly wrong. And that's okay, because for that application, divide by zero doesn't mean anything. So there are many possible paths through the execution. And if one of them wanders off base, then what Martin Reinhardt says is, using specifications to generate code to look at data structures and their consistency, why don't you just repair it and go on? In fact, he does that. So he gave a sort of philosophical talk about this at Uppsala 2 years ago. And there are, he and his student had another paper submitted to Uppsala this year. And one of the reviewers called it mind-bogglingly stupid. So let me tell you a story. It's too bad John isn't here because I quoted. So in the History of Programming Languages, version 1, he wrote, referring to 1958, the recursive definition of differentiation made no provision for erasure of abandoned list structure. You know what that means, so this is something we know about. No solution was apparent at the time, but the idea of complicating the elegant definition of differentiation with explicit erasure was unattractive. Okay. So to translate, he's saying, well, when you're doing symbolic differentiation and you don't put in erasure, so that's say to clean up when you abandon some of the structure, you have written a bug in your program. But they couldn't figure out how to fix it because what they worried about was the result was unattractive.
Right.
They didn't say it was inefficient or hard to figure out. They said it was unattractive. It was the beauty of the program that was foremost. Mm-hmm. So he wrote that about 19. He wrote that referring to 1958. I think he actually wrote it in 1980-something. So Gregor Cassales, people we kind of know and maybe love, one of the CWAS guys, wrote in 1997. So he's the aspects of that. We have found many programming problems for which neither procedural nor object-oriented programming techniques are sufficient to clearly capture some of the important design decisions the program must implement. This forces the implementation of those design decisions to be scattered throughout the code, resulting in tangled code that is excessively difficult to develop and maintain. So you separate that concern out. Martin Reinhardt wrote in this presentation I referred to in 2003, the goal of perfection is counterproductive. The aspiration to eliminate as many programming errors as possible creates a development process that diffuses the focus of the project, wastes engineering resources, and produces brittle software that is helpless in the presence of the inevitable errors or faults. A more productive aspiration is to develop systems that contain errors and sometimes behave imperfectly, but remain within their acceptable operating envelope. Continued on. flawed software has enormous value. The most productive path to better software systems will involve the combination of partially faulty software with techniques that monitor the execution and, when necessary, respond to faults or errors by taking action to appropriately adjust the state of behavior. So all of those ideas that I just talked about, 1997 through now. And so, quoting myself, here today. The simplicity and elegance of the program was not to be compromised by the inclusion, so it's talking about the McCarthy symbolic differentiation, list erasure bug. Right? So there what was happening was bugs in the code. The simplicity and elegance of the program was not to be compromised by the intrusion of an unrelated aspect of the program. Instead, the program was allowed to fail, as they run out of free scripts, you know, free storage, and by a process of observing its environment, noticing that it failed, it was able to avert disaster and initiate a process of repair to fix the mess the programmer's error had created. Importantly, the memory management concern was isolated in a separate module, separate from the program that the programmer is interested in, and in fact, separate from every other program. So garbage collection is allowing you to write buggy code, noticing the failure, and repairing it, using an aspect.
Elegant buggy code.
Pardon?
Elegant buggy code.
Right. So, we started to outline some simple principles to try to tie up. Assume failure is common, seek out repair errors, write tests and continue to run them, use feedback, make things visible. So I'm not going to get through the whole talk, so some of the slides are painted out. So I won't say there was one of these two people who called the Martin Reinhardt work mind-bogglingly stupid. Someone else could say that. They wrote, "We have found that even well-tested code written by experts contains a surprising number of obvious bugs." A big surprise to all of you. Has a hotline to the New York Times. So fixing code, running tests. Now, when we started looking at some of these ideas, one of the people, perhaps you know, is Ron Goldman. He's a player in my band, he's done his work with me, so he's kind of well known. He's this field a little bit. I told him about a year and a half ago, you know, we could probably learn a lot from biology, go become a biologist. So he did. And so one of the interesting things was he brought back is chemotaxis. How many here know what chemotaxis is? Okay, so I'm going to attempt to describe it. I could never understand this organic chemistry stuff. It's kind of interesting. Basically, it's something that let's talk about only E. coli. So a bacteria that lives inside of you, each of one of you. It is really good at following gradients. And so if there is a very sparse, you know, faint gradient, just a faint smell, something could be interesting, it can follow that line. And then if that builds up to unbelievable concentration, it can still follow gradients there. So it took a long time to figure out how it does it, and it does it with an interesting set of nested feedback loops. So think about this. The way this works is all that this thing can do, the only control that it has, is it has a flagellum. So a flagellum has a bunch of something sticking out here. Right, cilia sticking out. And if it gets turned by a motor in one direction, then they all sort of go coherently and roughly goes in a straight line. If you reverse the motor and spins in the opposite direction because of sort of the geometry of the chemicals that make it up, the proteins that make it up, it kind of gets all distorted and it spins. So the only control it has is tumble or kind of go straight. So what this does is if there's nothing that it senses or the gradient is flat, then it's through one of these feedback loops. So this thing becomes, except over there, this thing becomes activated, and these PY proteins or whatever they're called get activated. It causes the motor to go into tumble mode. So now look around for a direction to go. Once it finds something, then the frequency with which this reaction happens diminishes, so that it tends to go in a straight line. So all it can do is change the frequency with which it switches between tumbling and going straight. These two feedback loops here, what they do is, once it finds some stuff that it's interested in, then it methylates its sensing surface and makes it less sensitive. So now it needs more of the stuff, a higher concentration, to consider it's in the mode of going straight rather than tumbling. And then once it sort of found some nirvana and it doesn't have anything, then the fact that it's highly methylated causes one of these other feedback loops to sort of bring it back down, so it goes, starts looking for, you know, less and less concentrated stuff. This is a completely complicated thing. It's a program. If you watch simulations of this, it's completely amazing what it does. And notice that it's written with oscillators, feedback loops, with concentrations of stuff, with sensitivities. It doesn't have loops per se, except feedback loops are sort of like that. Completely amazing to do this sort of thing. So this led us back to looking at some ideas that Umberto Maturana, Francisco Varela, and others had, actually in 1973, and this is when he wrote it up in 81, called autopoiesis. So, kind of a weird looking word. The root for poiesis is the same root as for poetry, so I like it. So, poiesis, creation, auto, self, self-creation. So in 1973, written down 1981, Maturana wrote, a complicated thing, autopoiesis is systems that are defined as unities, a thing, as networks of productions of components, so things that produce, you know, a network of stuff that produces components, that recursively, through their interactions, generate and realize the network that produces them, and constitute in the space in which they exist the boundaries of the network as components that participate in the realization of the network. So basically what this is saying is, these are components in a network that create themselves. This is sort of a definition of what life is like. Santa Fe Institute and Stuart Kaufman defines a similar thing that's more in the biochemical realm called autocatalytic systems, where you need a catalyst to get something going in some reaction, but then that reaction produces the catalyst that keeps it going. So you think, well, you know, 1970s, a lot of drugs, white swapping, people are kind of nuts. So in 1790, Immanuel Kant was talking about what is the difference between life and machines. He said about life, in such a natural product as this, a living thing, every part is thought as owing its presence, its existence, to the agency of all the remaining parts, and also as existing for the sake of the others and of the whole. The part must be an organ producing the other parts, each consequently, reciprocally, producing the others. So in mind-boggling language of his own, he wrote the same thing. So this is contrasted with allopoiesis. Allo means other, so other creating. So it's the process whereby a system produces something other than the system itself. So that's kind of like this manufacturing model I talked about earlier. And, I won't read this, but basically Kant wrote the same thing, saying, well, if you look at a watch, all of the parts relate to each other, but it's not living because no part is there because another part created it. So we started to realize, oh, you know, there was kind of a thing that was going on in the 70s and 80s of looking at autopoiesis. So Terry Winograd looked at it, Brian Smith looked at it, a lot of people looked at this concept and said, oh, living systems are pretty different from the software we have. And this explains why most of our systems today are fragile, that they are allopoietic, that they are creating something else. They are created by us. We create it. And then they create other stuff. They don't create themselves. They don't create their own other components that are part of them. So there's the fact that we build allopoietic systems, and that if you think about it, until the 90s, we didn't have, in general, programs that ran for very long. Mean time between failures was relatively high. So if something, so for example, Windows systems in the early 90s, when people started putting conservative garbage collectors or otherwise detect memory leaks, they noticed that, you know, Unix code, Windows system just grew and grew and grew, and they would eventually fall over. Most importantly, our whole educational system is geared toward teaching allopoietic programming. Okay? So the observation is, when a complex system needs to live for a long time, living becomes the ultimate goal. So now if you think about allopoietic software and your body, for example, what do they call it? What do they call the mechanism that helps you out when there's a bug in your program or an error in your program? It's called an exception handler, meaning that failure is the exception. Exception handlers are horrendously awful programming models for them. If you look at your DNA and what percentage of it is redundant, what percentage of your body's mechanisms are keeping you alive, it's 95%. The fact that you do anything productive otherwise is kind of a miracle. So it's the exact opposite between you, the autopoietic system, and your code, the allopoietic system. So, looking at some of these, looking at some of those principles that I started to write down earlier, in making things visible, we want to use telemetry, descriptions, and stigmergy. So stigmergy is actually my favorite word for this year. So it was invented by Pierre-Paul Grasset, and it refers to, talks about trying to figure out how ants and termites build the unusual things that they do. So these termites will build these towers, and then they'll become these beautiful arches. How do they do that? So they probably don't have Christopher Alexander, the architect, design anything for them. Or I don't have a blueprint that they're using. Or I don't have the queen telling everyone, okay, now you go here, do that. Somehow they're doing this. So the idea is stigmergy, which is communicating in decentralized systems by kind of leaving chemical traces. So I can explain how stigmergy explains into these termite things. The Linda system that Belerner came up with is stigmergy. So as we were thinking about this, we were wondering, okay, so if the way to do this conscientious software is really like doing these autopoietic systems, how could we actually make sense of that? And so when you read that description, the definition of an autopoietic system, you thought, okay, this guy is nuts. He's talking about creating some kind of programming system that mostly is recreating itself all the time. Programming with feedback loops and oscillators and stuff like that. Did he forget that banking systems have to be written this way? Okay. Did he realize that we can't afford to waste 95% of the CPU on keeping the thing alive? What is he thinking? And there's information hiding, remember that? In computer science, the principle of information hiding is the hiding of design decisions in a computer program that are most likely to change, thus protecting other parts of the program from change if the design decision is changed. And this is the fundament on which all of our progress has been made. So think about an autopoietic system. It's going to be dealing with gradients, with smells, with concentrations, with feedback loops. It's going to be emergent. It's going to be like the game of life, you know, this unbelievable structure is kind of emerging. And then you've got code like the banking system that you're working on here today. So if we look at the principles, compare them, there's visibility and transparency on one side and information hiding on the other. One of them is probably dynamic with flexible interfaces, to avoid errors. The other one is static and rigid interfaces. One is reactive, the other is manufactured. One is self-generating and decentralized, the other is command and control or hierarchical. One is based on diversity and redundancy and abundance, the other on uniformity, parsimony, and efficiency. One is emergent, one reifies what's important. One is loosely coupled, one is tightly coupled, one is based on patterns of behavior, kind of recognizing local patterns, the other is based on signals. Do this, 3.141594, here a lost band, 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42. One is based on local rules, one is based on global reasoning. One is based on live languages, one is based on the usual suspects. How can you make sense of these two things? So we came up with this wacky picture. I probably don't have to explain it, but I will. What if what you did was you took your allopoietic system made out of components, so it can either be a distributed system or just a componentized system, and you embed it in an autopoietic system. What the autopoietic system is doing is it's keeping itself alive. It's also, by side effect, keeping regular code alive as well. So the interesting thing is the process of generating the allopoietic system is an allopoietic process, and perhaps at the beginning, the process of generating this weird auto-allopoietic hybrid is also allopoietic. So this means that we're going to have some kind of interface between the outside of the code that banking system programmers write and the kind of wacky code that I'm going to write. It's going to be using smells, it's going to be using dispersion, it's not going to be using, you know, message passing or anything like that, and the code that does do that. So we started to think about how this could make some sense. So this is kind of a little diagram we came up with. This is an ordinary component. It's blue. There might be some components inside, so Kevin, help me. This could be a jar file, and there's going to be classes inside, or this could be a package or a module or something with stuff inside. And the blue thing on the top is sort of the boxy looking thing, rectangle is the interface, and then the line is what it's talking to. So what you do is you add some of this stuff that I talked about into there. So you add the test code into the component so that you can run. You put in Reinhardt's repair code. You put in other things that sort of say, well, make a clone of yourself safely, or kill yourself but do it in a safe way. There's an interesting idea that Armando Fox, who's a researcher here, had based on muttering. So he has this idea of how to create more robust systems through micro reboots. So he imagines that you have a component like this, and you sprinkle in it mutter statements. So it just mutters something. It doesn't actually matter what it mutters. Probably you want it to mutter stuff that depends on what's going on inside, but you know, different branches of if statements, different loops will mutter different things. And so what you have it do is you have it, when it gets something to do, it sort of mutters it, and then it puts a period at the end. So now you've got these mutter statements, one after the other. So then you take the component and you train it on good data and bad data. You run a Bayesian learning system over it so that you can recognize the spammy behavior from the good behavior. So then you run the components with muttering on, and it classifies whether this component seems to be working well or seems to be going wacky. If it goes wacky, he micro-reboots it. So then this has to talk to this autopoietic stuff outside, which is going to be crowding around the system. It's going to be saying, gee, you know, what kind of feels to me, you know, based on what I smell, that you should be running some tests and doing something about it. So somehow this code is going to have to talk to the code on the inside. And notice I used this blending trick. And there'll be other of these sort of modules on the outside talking to these outer coil components. And maybe there'll be ones that do rewiring, say, well, you know, code was actually not quite right, so let's try to do this repair. So the idea is to have these things, we couldn't think of a good name to call them, EPI modules that control installation, they run tests, they do cloning, they do apoptosis, which as you all know is programmed cell death. So normally when some cells in your body need to go away, they don't just randomly go away. What happens is there's proteins that stick out through the walls, and other bodies come along and say, you know, you smell like you should die now. And it sends you the signal that says, kill yourself. So that's apoptosis, the muttering thing I just mentioned. So I've been talking about this smell and stuff like that. And so we have like a web server here, and red is the autopoietic part. It kind of smells that there's a big surge of web requests. Because there's a delay built in, that smell sort of disperses, and then the other autopoietic entities will sort of reconfigure the software on the fly. That's the end of the digression. So, to return to the end of the digression, one of the interesting things about this idea of separating the autopoietic from the allopoietic capabilities is, suppose the autopoietic part just plain doesn't work, or someone decides, this is crazy, I'm just going to delete it. Well, then the program is only going to be as bad as you wrote it. So why work on this sort of stuff? So I'm going to a workshop tomorrow at the Santa Fe Institute where what they wanted me to do was do a little presentation on what are the big sort of evolutionary transitions that we've gone through in software so far. And they're imagining that there's some big kingdom phylum type of ontology of biological kind of programming languages and systems. And what I'm going to tell them is, well, we're kind of just starting off in the bacteria phase right now, as far as we're concerned. So we're in the infancy. And, you know, our software is like our children. For a time, parents must provide everything and be prepared to step in to prevent the next disaster. We expect that after a time, the child will mature, will grow up, will be able to take care of itself, to solve problems, to cope, and perhaps to contribute something new. Initially selfish, what other options are there? The child becomes responsible. With luck or persistence, or as the result of good, or as the result of good upbringing, the child may become conscientious. Shall we hope similarly for our software?
You once wrote a book about benchmarking something or other, and at the conference in 1984, you said, don't benchmark programs, benchmark programmers.
Yep.
Why are you not today saying, don't make your software conscientious, make your programmers conscientious?
Well, because so, since I have been not active in this world, I've noticed the programmers have become quite conscientious. And they've tried their darndest to sort of make systems robust, to design them well. They're trying everything to make them really think. And so I think the old hope of AI should be alive again, and we should try to have the software actually help out. So Moore's Law, I mean, you all know this, and I'll say it anyway. Moore's Law works because the tools that you use to design hardware with are improved by the hardware improving. Right. So it's autopoietic. So that's why Moore's Law works for hardware. That's why it doesn't work for software, because we don't use the tool, even the meager tools that we have. So I was in a conversation with Mike Ball and Guy Steele this morning. And they were commenting that software developers are the most conservative people on the face of the planet, even more conservative than Tom DeLay or something like that. They just do not want to change anything. And if you sit on programming committees, for scientific or computer science conferences, you'll notice that they talk about the salami slice problem. What is the smallest possible contribution that is worth being published at this conference? And so what happens is if you watch the program committee members, they read a paper and say, no, this is a multiple submission. I already read this paper. This is plagiarism. Now what it is, it's the person doing their research program making the smallest possible advance. We're in total gridlock and decline with Thomson Scientific right now. And this is one place where we could do that. Way in the back.
So before I ask this, let me preface it with the fact that I'm a biologist. I believe what you're saying. So I think this is a straw person, not as a real complaint. But in about 3.5 billion years, we've managed to get to E. coli.
Yep.
And in about the last 100 years, we managed to get airplanes to fly at 40,000 feet, 700 miles an hour, carrying 300 people. So, one might say, well, the issue isn't the bank. The issue is that engineering is better than these systems. And in another 100 years, I guarantee we'll be able to out-engineer the microbes. Now, these systems might not be autopoietic. That is, the airplane is not autopoietic. But it sure as hell does a good job of getting us to the moon when on the airplane.
Well, at the end?
Yeah.
So, a couple of things. One is, you might notice that DC-3s were more autopoietic than the Boeing 777, where the DC-3 would roughly fly itself. So that's kind of interesting. The second thing is, if you look at any sort of engineering, like airplanes, since you brought it up, there's just a stupendous number of failures that people did in producing those systems to learn from them. So the example that's always brought up in the Auditorium community is, well, software developers should be like bridge designers. We know how to design bridges, just do that. And they sort of ignore the 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 years of building a bridge and sending some horses across to see if it falls down and sort of discover what those principles are. And so in my formulation here, all I'm interested in is using what we can learn from our own thinking, from looking at the laws of physics, looking at other sort of metaphorical domains such as biology, to adapt some of those techniques to try to help our systems be more robust. And that for flying to the moon on a regular plane or other sorts of intellectual activity, you have to leave that and let that engineering go on, but assist it in some ways, which we're not doing now. Jim McDonald.
I'm coming at it more from a formal methods perspective, a little bit professional. But I think there's not as much of a gap or a distinction as you might be making. One of the things we talked about is specification carrying code, which is autopoietic in a large sense, where you have the code, and it's not just the code, but it's got a description of how it was built. And so
Martin Reinhardt, if you look at his work, what he does is he starts with a formal spec of what the data structure should be. From that, he automatically generates testing and repair code model. So if there's any contribution to this, which I don't think there is, except for entertainment value, it's to make this distinction of auto and allopoietic so that now when you go back and you talk to Cordell, you can say, oh, there's another way of thinking about what we're doing. And so when you have that other way, that can open up sort of new opportunities for thinking more broadly. So the whole point of giving the McCarthy garbage collection thing wasn't to say, yeah, well, this guy's anticipated, acceptance-oriented programming aspects and all that, but to say that if you go back and you sort of look and re-narrate that story, the story seems fairly different than what we thought it was, and that opens up new insights.
So you mentioned there have been a lot of mistakes on the engineering front, but the 3.2 million years of evolution produced a lot of pretty bad mistakes that didn't survive to be here. And and another consequence of we all almost see it now. My wife is a doctor, and I tell her that I expect that in you know, my lifetime, my job will be much more like hers. But one of the consequences of that is now, you know, the avian flu is queuing up to kill, you know, 20 million people sometime in the next couple decades. And we, if we have lifelike software, we have, you know, epidemics of, you know, the autopoietic minders run amok and, you know, keel over and die. I mean, I guess that's part of an acceptable cost of doing business, or have you guys thought about, well, but they, at the moment, they fail in ways that are ultimately understandable, but like modern medicine can't explain, you know, certain diseases. And so I guess, you know, I'm actually sort of with that. Like, I think that'll be fine and we'll accept the ambiguity, but have you thought about how to deal with or mitigate that kind of lack of understanding?
A tiny bit. I'm going to fall back if I could quote Henry Lieberman, which is, because you can't solve all of the hard problems, doesn't mean you shouldn't work on the easy ones first. I think that's a tendency that we have is to work on hard problems, but incrementally, rather than work on bigger problems and baby steps.
You mentioned earlier about the junk DNA, 95% of human DNA is junk. That got revised about 3 years ago. It seems that in Scientific American, September, October of 91, and then recapitulated in November of 2004, they finally, by normal progression, they noticed that this stuff, it increases quadratically in the complexity of a mammal or animal. And that quadratic complexity led to the theory, which was then tested and proven, that this stuff is, although you're not getting one protein per gene, you're having these control genes. So there is an incredible complexity in these control genes growing quadratically with the size of the individual, this making sure it doesn't fall apart as it grows larger. And that may fit in better with the autopoiesis theory.
Actually, what you just said is what I was trying to say.
Sorry about that.
That all of this stuff that's there is for redundancy and checksumming and you know, keeping
the messenger. Messenger and so I think it's what controls. But I thought the biologist in the crowd would try to correct us there.
I don't correct biologists.
Thank you.
Right.
It's
close enough.
To take that further, you can go out really, really far, you know, 99.999999% of the DNA on the planet is used for one purpose, which is replicating that DNA. This is not a very interesting problem. If we were to do this with computation, you're talking about a huge amount of resources just sitting there, just spinning its wheels. Like given all the DNA on this planet, most of it's going into making more insects. Very, very little of it is going into making human beings with interesting ideas.
Microbes.
We'll probably, most of it's going into
microbes first, insects second. Human beings are really, really far down on that list. Yeah, this is an extraordinarily inefficient way of going about it.
Well, but the mechanisms that I'm looking at, for example, are the ones that are in the bacteria and this. The bulk of the biomass, which isn't very interesting biologically in some sense, just some simple techniques for keeping the stuff alive, number one. Number two, some of the machines that are about to be built are kind of radically insane when it comes to computational power. And they face the problem of probably failing most of the time anyway. So, for example, there are some people I know who are trying to design servers using flash memory rather than RAM or disk drives. You can only write that about a million times, and partway there, it kind of gets flaky. Other machines that I know of that are being designed that, probably some components can be failing every few milliseconds. So you have to do something to keep this stuff alive. I'm not talking about, let's have some big soup of evolutionary software code that kind of does this whole biology thing and recreates the complexity, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm talking about using the inspiration of the ideas, there's some simple mechanisms, maybe we should program part of the system that's keeping the rest of it alive using feedback loops and oscillators rather than loops, indexes and stuff like that. So I'm not talking about some wacky, you know, SFI type of program. I'm talking about, you know, what is the minimal amount of stuff we can add to sort of help us out a little.
Right, I agree with your clarification on it. It makes a lot of sense, but you can go without that clarification, it can sound pretty in the dark.
Well, that's right, because that's what a keynote is for. Keynote 101, that's my advice to you. So, should we quit soon, John?
Yeah. 6:20, it's 6:20 and we've got to eat by 8 o'clock.
Yeah, so.